Luke. Luke. Ben? You will listen to the Wampa's Lair podcast. Podcast? There you will hear your hosts, Carl LeClaire and Jason Hunt, as they discuss all things Star Wars. So join the conversation and hang out. Oh, and watch out for Wampas.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to another exciting episode of the Wampa's Lair podcast. This is episode number 180. Jeez, that's a lot. Top five prequel elements. I am, as always, one of your hosts, Jason Hunt, and with me we have the Watto to my Dexter Jetster. We have Carl LeClaire.
Let me take you out back, huh? We'll find what we love about the prequels.
These prequels, they're movies. Damn good ones, too.
Oh, Jason, it's time to love on the prequels.
Yes,
It's been too long.
It has. We've spent a lot of time talking about Force Awakens, all the new stuff. It's time to revisit some of the old a bit. And it's weird when you say old and the prequels are the topic, but it has been over 15 years since... Over 10 years since the last prequel was released in theaters. So, it's been a while.
Yeah, May is rolling around, and May is the anniversary of every Star Wars movie besides Force Awakens. Mm-hmm. So, and obviously we've got May the 4th coming up in less than a week.
It's exciting. I cannot wait for Joe Hogan's Panic Over Munilus trailer to hit the interwebs.
Yes, and we'll be having him on for that episode so he can talk to you guys about it.
Yes.
So, lots of exciting things, obviously, always going on in the Star Wars world. But like we said in our last episode, we really wanted to get into some prequel stuff because we haven't really done much with it in a while because we've been so busy with Force Awakens stuff. And then the Blu-ray came out and Rogue One trailer came out. Rebels was coming to an end. There's been a lot of things going on. But we need to give some love to the prequels. And Jason, I've watched through the prequel trilogy. Well... all three movies plus Phantom Menace twice, and I'm in love with these films. And I'm an OT guy. If you've been listening to the show, I'm an OT guy. Jason's the PT guy, but I love the prequels. And at the end of this episode, I'm going to reveal my new order of how I rank the Star Wars films. Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Whoa.
Jason, before we even get into all this love we have for episodes 1, 2, and 3. Mm-hmm. We had a really fun poll that you gave us on our last episode about whether we'd rather be a Force user or a bounty hunter. And once again, Larians had a lot to say, had a large voice in this. So, Jason, what do they say?
Well, they said a lot. And as I should have expected, we got an additional response that wasn't actually one of the options. We have one vote for a TIE fighter washer. Somebody wanted to watch TIE Fighters. We only got 3 votes for a bounty hunter, which shocked me somewhat, which means Force user won. And including yours and my votes, Carl, mm-hmm. Force user got 32. So 32 to 3 to 1 for a TIE Fighter washer.
First off, 36 responses. That's awesome. Thank you.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's amazing. And then, I figured Force user would probably win, but I didn't expect it to win by this much.
I think the Force is one of the most unique elements of the Star Wars saga. So It doesn't surprise me that much because bounty hunters, they exist in our world and very different ways. They don't look awesome. Unless, Dog the Bounty Hunter, he's pretty big.
Right.
But, I wasn't surprised that it won in a landslide like this because, come on, let's think about it. If you can use the Force, you could do mind tricks, you can force push, force electricity if you're upset. There are so many things you can do, which is obviously why I picked a Force user. And Jason, I like, though, that you didn't specify Jedi or Bounty Hunter.
Right.
So Force user does not imply that one is a Jedi. Hello, Maz Kanata.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I kept it as general as possible there, because I figured if it was Jedi or Bounty Hunter, that would probably skew it slightly. All the Sith lovers would vote Bounty Hunter. So I was like, let's just make it as general as possible, as broad as possible. So Force user, Bounty Hunters, and Force users cleared the house, cleaned up, swept the floor with the Bounty Hunters, and and then there was the TIE Fighter watcher in the background just polishing something.
Right.
TIE Fighter, so.
Right.
But anyway. So we've got a cool team matchup for you at the end of this episode, but we have a topic to get to before we get there, don't we, Carl?
It's a very fun one, Jason, and I've been looking forward to this all week.
Yes, I know.
I actually just I picked up from the library a book called The Cinema of George Lucas, and I can't remember who writes it. I know it has a foreword by Ron Howard, but it's a really great book. It's not nearly as in-depth as a J.W. Rinzler making of book, but it kind of charts George Lucas's career up through Revenge of the Sith. I kind of skipped over all the OT stuff just because I've been reading the Rinzler stuff. That's going to give me a lot more than what you're going to get from this smaller book. But right. I finished the chapter on Phantom Menace, and I will say this. George Lucas, when he sat down to do these prequels, has some great ideas. And, I think the biggest thing that was of most importance that he talked about was that these were going to be different styles of movies, which was obviously why, the OT fans were so shocked by it, because it wasn't the mm-hmm. same thing.
Right.
But to me, I give props to George Lucas, because good for him for not telling the same story all over again or doing the same stuff. I think George Lucas deserves all the respect in the world for multiple reasons, but specifically these prequels that he came at with such an imagination, like he always does, and told a great story.
Yeah. And he had very specific things in mind when he made these. And, he's not just throwing movies together willy-nilly. So he specific goals, specific styles, and specific technologies that he wanted to work on and improve on. So,
right.
He doesn't make a movie just for the sake of making a movie. He makes a movie to further filmmaking.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, Jason, we kind of did like a top five thing with, of course, honorable mentions.
Of course.
We just choose not to call these things top seven episodes, even though we could. But we both obviously have a couple of honorable mentions. And Jason, I'm excited to hear what your first one is.
Okay. My first honorable mention element of the prequel is the prophecy of the Chosen One. And this is, obviously something that gets introduced during The Phantom Menace, but it carries over because Anakin is supposed to be this prophesied Chosen One. And the idea of what that means, and the Chosen One will bring balance to the Force, and the different ideas and disagreements that some of the characters have. Mace Windu doesn't seem to believe that Anakin is the Chosen One by the time we get to Revenge of the Sith, because Obi-Wan says, isn't he not the Chosen One to bring balance to the Force? Mm. So the prophecy says, Mace Windu's a jerk. but it is one of these things, and of course, this prophecy is what drives Qui-Gon so hard in The Phantom Menace to have Anakin be part of the Jedi Order. And it's this through line that you can't escape when you talk about the prequels and you deal with the prequels. And I don't know, it's one of those things that, while it's not the most, thing that catches my attention the most, I do like it. And of course, we get to see the culmination of that prophecy when we get to Return of the Jedi and see Anakin reemerge and bring balance to the Force. So, and everyone knows that Return of the Jedi is my favorite Star Wars movie. So anything that the prequels can do that helps, you know, Return of the Jedi look cooler is okay in my book.
Yeah, that's a really good one. You know, when I was watching Phantom Menace this morning, there's that scene when, you know, they're about to leave for Naboo again, and you know, the Force is strong with him, Ki-Adi Mundi says, and then Qui-Gon says, mm-hmm. he's to be trained then? And then Mace Windu, just looking like such a lazy punk, just goes, no, he'll not be trained. And there's a, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Jake Lloyd as Anakin, not because it's Jake Lloyd, it's just, if you've listened to the show before, you know I'd prefer like a little bit of an older character to play Anakin, but that's neither here nor there. But Jake Lloyd does this great little facial expression acting where he kind of glares. They shoot, you know, they show Qui-Gon's expression of like shock, but then they go down to Anakin and it zooms in on Anakin's face and you just see him kind of like glare, kind of squint his eyes and glare at Mace Windu. So mm-hmm. to me, it's almost like his distrust and dislike of Mace Windu starts there. And it makes sense too. Mace Windu screws Anakin. So
yeah, Mace Windu's not a fan of Anakin and right. vice versa.
Yeah.
So,
and you know, I think this prophecy element to the prequels is it gives it as much as the, like the PT is not the hero's journey. It at least makes it though. It gives it that like that sense of fairy tale though. Again, because mm-hmm. there's something, you know, extra human to it.
And it's also the most spiritual thing mm-hmm. about the Force in the prequels. Obviously, you know, we know by this time the Jedi Order has become more of a bureaucracy than a you know. An established order following the Force. Mm-hmm. But the prophecy of the Chosen One is the most spiritual element that transitions the entire prequels. And so while the Force is definitely a very spiritual thing in the OT and so far in the sequel trilogy, there's not a lot of that in the prequels, so having this element to that gives it that sort of fairy tale, spiritual whimsy.
Right, absolutely, and I think that that's an important element of it, and it really does. It highlights, you know, and you said this on one of our past episodes, Jason, but when Mace Windu does say, like, you refer to the prophecy of the one who brings balance to the Force, you believe it's this boy. You know, there's almost this skepticism in it, almost as if, you know, the Jedi know that that prophecy exists, but they're just kind of like, eh, whatever. Like, it's not a big deal. You know, they've mm-hmm. kind of pushed it aside because they've become so codified and so bureaucratic that the spirituality of what it means to be a Jedi has almost been pushed to the back burner. And that's why this prophecy just is almost like, okay, sure, Qui-Gon. Yeah, you found it. All right. But it's interesting, too, because it's the one element of the prequels that's abundantly clear from the first moments of The Force Awakens, because Lor San Tekka references the fact that the Force is out of balance without the Jedi. So this is an element that's introduced here in Episode One that carries over, obviously, into the sequel trilogy.
Mm-hmm. So what's your first honorable mention?
Well, my first honorable mention...
We spent a lot of time talking about that.
That's okay. Like I said, it's kind of like a top seven. But my first honorable mention is all the lightsaber fights in the prequels. You know, not just the duels in and of themselves, but just the fact that we see so many Jedi fighting with lightsabers. It's exciting. It's fun. And, you know, right from the get-go in The Phantom Menace, you know, Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan just like making short work of battle droids. There's just such a quickness and a martial art to the lightsaber fighting and the prequels that I really like. It's got my favorite duel of the Star Wars films in Episode One. You know, I think some of the duels got to be, I mean, I will say the one flaw I think in the lightsaber fights is there's almost too many of them, specifically in Revenge of the Sith. You know, the best duels are the ones that have the most like emotional weight to them. I mean, they're just the style of it. They're fast, they're intense. They're George Lucas. But they really are. It's an art form. It's a Jedi art form, and you get to see that come alive on screen in a way that you just don't see it in the OT. You know, and I think that's really cool. And I like the, you know, man, I'm gonna probably be talking about Phantom Menace a lot today. But in the Phantom Menace, you know, after Qui-Gon's first encounter with Darth Maul, you know, when he's like exhausted on the Thiege, you know, on the ship, You know, what was that? I'm not sure, but it was well trained in the Jedi arts. He mm-hmm. references that it's the Jedi arts, you know? So I yes. think that's what's so cool, you know? Some of the critique that the lightsaber fighting gets is like, oh, it's so flashy, it's not realistic. It's like, well, it kind of is, because Jedi, in a way, are kind of like monks. It's kind of like, you know, like Buddhist monks from, you know...
The warrior monks.
The warrior monks yeah. who like sword fighting isn't necessarily strictly for combat. It's a form of art. It's a form of their spirituality. It's a form of expression. Mm-hmm. And I think that's yeah. very true for the Jedi. And it's true for the Sith as well, you know, because they fight in a similar way. It's just more aggressive.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, obviously the lightsaber elements are a great portion of the prequel trilogy.
Yeah. And I will have more to say on that later.
I figured you might.
My second honorable mention, we're just going to go ahead and move into that, will be actually the politics. And I know most people roll their eyes when people talk about, you know, the prequels and politics, you know, taxation of the trade routes, oh, the Senate, you know, all that stuff. I find it kind of interesting. You know, I don't mind the occasional political thriller as far as movies are concerned. And while this isn't a political thriller by any stretch of the imagination, there's political machinations going on. And I think part of it is, as I was growing up with the prequels, my interest in politics was developing as well. And so when I saw that in the prequels and, you know, sort of, I went, oh, so that's politics in the galaxy far, far away. You know, I was also interested in politics here locally. So I thought that was kind of cool. But I do like the political element to the prequels and the way that it's all set up. Because obviously, and part of that's very key to the story of the prequels, because we are set in the areas of political power, which is why things are so sleek and shiny, and it's not the used future that we know from the OT. You go to Tatooine or Geonosis, it's very different though. So, but you can't escape it from the prequels. You can't escape the political element in this. And of course, you know, there's a lot of stuff with Palpatine and his political machinations that, you know, bring about the fall of the Republic and the rise of the Empire. And we see a transition of political power throughout the prequels, which is, you know, obviously similar to historical happenings with, you know, Rome with Caesar, and then in Germany following World War I with Hitler. So it's stuff that can happen if we're not careful, and I just like it. So,
Well, it's interesting because we asked on our Facebook page what, you know, some of our Larian's favorite elements of the prequels were, and I was surprised to see actually a couple people mention the politics.
Mm-hmm.
I think
Cody said that it inspired him to go into law school. Actually,
right. Yeah. So which is awesome. You know, it's not. This would not be on my list.
I didn't think it would be.
But I don't dislike them. I remember reading an article on like NPR about like they were analyzing the government of the prequel movies and like mm-hmm. talking about how bogus it would be in real life. But, you know, again, it's a fanciful world. It's not meant to be literal. And they give us enough of the basics. I think there's nothing wrong with it. Mm-hmm. And ultimately what George Lucas was intending to do with that story is show how a republic fell. And yeah. the reality that it can happen and how corruption works, you know? Yep. So, I think it's an extremely important element of these films. It's not the most exciting element for me, but it's an essential element for sure.
Yeah.
You know, it specifically Palpatine. I mean, the dude's a political mastermind, so that was great to watch. You know, in Attack of the Clones, the way he manipulates Jar Jar and gets the emergency powers, and you know, the way he continues to exercise them throughout Revenge of the Sith. I mean, it's incredible. He's a charismatic, popular leader, and it shows the danger of that when their intentions are not for the greater good.
Right. Exactly.
So yeah, it's an extremely important part of this story. And again, something I read in that book the other day is just that George Lucas's intention is kind of to write a history. That was the point of the prequels. It's not a hero's journey fable again. It's a history of what got us there. So you're going to have these elements. So I think it's a compelling part. It's not my favorite part by any means, but it's definitely a compelling and an important part.
That it is. So what's your next honorable mention?
My next honorable mention is, I just kind of call it the look, the scenery of the prequels. And I'll say a little bit more about that even a little bit later. But I just love the way things, you know, look in all of these movies. The CGI is a little bit much in Attack of the Clones, and I don't think it's quite as good as it could be. Like, by Revenge of the Sith, the CGI is caught up. Everything looks pretty great to me. Phantom Menace, they've done a great job of still using a lot of practicality as well as effects. I think it looks great there. Attack of the Clones is the only one that now doesn't, to me, hold up quite as well. That being said, I still love the look of these movies, specifically Naboo. It's beautiful.
Ugh. Yes.
You know, and, you know, you get the sleekness of Coruscant. You know, it's such a great visually looking movie. And everything is new. Everything's clean. And I like that because, again, like you kind of said earlier, Jason, it's the prequels are not in the same used galaxy that we were in for the original trilogy. It's it's a new setting. This is the Washington, D.C., the Wall Street, New York City element of the Star Wars galaxy. Of course, everything is going to look nice and fancy. And I like that. Like, I like that it looks that way, but it still doesn't look like streamlined sci-fi. You know, it's not like weird gadgety stuff. It's still very Star Wars, but it's everything's neat. And I like that, too, because of the story element. It shows everything kind of as beautiful before everything falls apart. You know, to me, Naboo is kind of the... It's the Eden of the Star Wars story. Everything is beautiful and rich and you know, green. Everything is great there. And to me, that's kind of, it's a precursor of showing what the galaxy looked like before the Empire.
It's also where Palpatine is from, though. So
true.
It's a poisoned apple in there somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Great analogy. Again, when I watch these movies, the one thing I'm really, really, really focused on is just a lot of the scenery and a lot of the cinematography in it. And that stuff honestly, like, easily allows me to overlook some of the other flaws. You know, there's certain scenes where it's like, okay, the acting's a little, like the picnic scene in Attack of the Clones. It's kind of cheesy acting, but it's this beautiful waterfall and this like really beautiful meadow. I mean, the symbolism there is a good enough for me that I can overlook the kind of awkward acting and still enjoy that scene. So, yeah, I mean, I think just the look in general of the prequels is fantastic.
Very cool. That kind of transitions into my number five, which is going to be the world building that happened with the prequels. We had, you know... handful of planets and locations and, you know, groups of people that was developed with the original trilogy. But it's like we got to the prequels and George Lucas turned that up. He more planets, more locations on, you know, familiar planets, new aliens to add to the old, and new groups of people and just so much new life into this universe was created. The worlds and the organizations and the differences between peoples on the same planet. You know, you've got the Gungans and the Naboo on Naboo. You know, they've got their own societies there, and just the scope of everything got so much bigger with the prequels, and that's always been fascinating to me, and it's always been something that I've enjoyed about the prequels and helped to propel my imagination farther when I'm making up my own stories, you know, in Star Wars and that sort of thing. So it just the scale of the world building and the increased amount of life and of people and places that was developed with the prequels has always been fascinating and interesting to me. So that's why it's number five on my list.
That's a good one. So kind of the world building.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. I think it, and I like the way you put it. You know, he takes things that were familiar, but expands them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like we do go back to Tatooine and every single one of the prequels, granted briefly in Revenge of the Sith, but we go back to Tatooine and it does still have that same, you know, look of everything's used and dirty, but we're in Mos Espa or, yeah. You know, we're in a different location. So it's not just revisiting just to revisit, which I think is really great. And, you know, I mean, this is obviously a prequel episode, but just, you know, in The Force Awakens, that was, you know, one critique a lot of people had was that all the new aliens everything was completely new. There was nothing to ground you in Star Wars in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I still think that's a valid critique and it's something I don't like.
Right.
And, you know, you don't have to have everything be the same, but that was what was great with George Lucas. Like, he gave us lots of new aliens that we'd never seen before, but, you know, you walk into Dexter Jester's diner. He himself is a new type of alien. There's some other, you know, there's some Dugs in there now too, which we've been introduced to. Or there's, you know, like a Biff,
couple of Rodians. And,
right. Yeah, Rodians are everywhere in Star Wars. Like,
yeah.
The fact that there wasn't at least one Rodian in Maz Kanata's castle is a little bit upsetting.
I know, right?
And that's all you really would have needed too.
Yeah. Or a hammerhead.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so that's absolutely true. It does. And I think George Lucas, again, he's telling a whole new story here. He's building something new. And, you know, you specifically, Jason, and even really me, we were growing up when the prequels were coming out. Granted, mm-hmm. I was still young for Phantom Menace, but by the time Revenge of the Sith came out, I mean, I was in college. But you know, specifically kids that grew up with the prequels, they love those movies. Those are the stories that, you know, that they have nostalgia for.
Oh yeah.
Oh,
definitely. Definitely. So what's your number five?
Well, my number five has to do with, you know, the story of Anakin's fall. You know, we finally get that element in Star Wars. You know, that was one thing everybody was excited to figure out, was what made Anakin fall to the dark side? How did Darth Vader become Darth Vader? Mm-hmm. And we get that story here. And what I like about this story, because I won't go into too much detail about the specific story. We did like 6 hours worth of episodes about that a while ago, mm-hmm. if not others. But what I really like about it is it's a new type of story. So, like, obviously in the OT, we have a hero's journey. We see the journey Luke takes into becoming the hero and the savior of the galaxy. But what we're getting in the prequels is the story of somebody's fall. It's a tragedy, you know, and, you know, it borrows elements of tragedy in this story. So it's exciting that we're getting something new there as well.
Right.
But, yeah, so, you know, watching Anakin's fall, and I will say, I do wish that there was more of it in episodes 2, and even maybe a hint of it in episode 1. I'm fine without being in episode 1. And I'll say why later. But I wish there was a little bit more than just the Tusken scene in Attack of the Clones. But, you know, that's fine, be it as it may. They've obviously done a great job of beefing that up in the Clone Wars.
Yes.
But yeah, you know, just finding out why Anakin falls is such an important part, if not the most important part, of the prequel trilogy. And what I like too is that it's very human, you know.
Yeah.
He falls, like, because Star Wars, in a sense, it's a fantasy story. It's, you know, it's a mythology that is, it's bigger than just your typical human experience. So the story of Anakin falling, like, he falls to the dark side, he's corrupted by these powers, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like all that big language that maybe not be so real, but what is very real is why he does all that, why he does tap into this dark side, why he, you know, has that fall from grace. It's because fear, which is one of the most common human attributes. He's afraid of losing the people he loves, and that's what sways him. Mm-hmm. And I love that. You know, I think it could have, you know, in Revenge of the Sith, I wish it was executed a tiny bit better visually, but it's such a great story. And I remember when he does fall in Revenge of the Sith, the first time I saw that movie, all I thought was, yes, this makes sense. I get that. You know, like we can understand why somebody would fall to try to protect the person they love the most. So I love that George Lucas made it human. Just like, you know, Luke Skywalker's kind of hero journey, there's so many elements there that are mythological, but yet they feed into real human experience. The same can be said about Anakin's fall. Is the reason he falls is because of very human reasons. So
yeah. And the thing about the human reasoning about his fall also shows you that there is a path to redemption, you know, later on. Mm-hmm. Because if it was going to be some sort of, you know, evil force corrupting thing that Palpatine did to him, you know, how do you undo that? You know, you'd have to come up with some sort of power on the light side that was as strong, if not stronger, to do that. And that would get into the whole fantasy, you know, magic kind of area. But when you, when the reasoning is, you know, it's a tempting and a, you know, coercing and a playing on fear, and he does things out of fear because he's trying to protect people that he loves, you see the path that that takes him down, but it's also open for a path to redemption at the end of the day too. It's just, you know, when he decides to take it and if he decides to take it and if he believes he's worth it. So by making it that sort of element there, that being the driving reason why he falls, it also sets up the believability of the redemption later on. So
exactly. You know, because Darth Vader, if you just watched A New Hope, Darth Vader is kind of just, he's the devil character. He's just a black and white villain.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, obviously through end of Return of the Jedi, when Luke takes that mask off and you see a human person who's very broken, right. You know, physically, mm-hmm. and then you watch the prequels, you understand what broke them. And like, I that's so well put, Jason, that there is obviously something that can bring him back. He's redeemable. Mm-hmm. You know, as a human person who obviously starts off as a very good human person, you know, as Padme says, and even as Luke says, there's still good in him.
Mm-hmm.
So, absolutely. Yeah. You know, this is, you can't talk prequels and not show some love for the story of Anakin's fall.
Oh, yeah. It's a great element to it.
Yeah.
It's a great thing. And it's not actually on my list directly. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of things that sort of surround it. My number four. Mm-hmm. We're going to get into the lightsaber combat. I love the lightsaber combat. It's higher on my list than yours because I love it. Swords have always been, you know, my favorite weapon when it comes to like movies and, you know, fantasy things and that sort of thing. I've always been a fan of the swords over blasters or anything. So when we get a laser sword that's powerful and can deflect blaster bolts, that sort of thing, I'm all for it. So you know lightsabers in general are going to be high on my list. Lightsaber combat, as you were saying, doesn't always have to pertain specifically to the duels, which are great, and I love them, mm-hmm. because there's all sorts of different styles to them, and they worked very hard to develop a martial language for each of the characters. Anakin fights a certain way. Obi-Wan fights a certain way. Dooku fights a certain way that's different than Maul fights and that sort of thing. Everyone has their own fighting style. Everyone has their own language. And then, of course, you know, all the Jedi fighting battle droids and, you know, other things of that nature. I love those scenes. In Geonosis Arena battle, one of my favorite scenes, period, in the prequels. So you know I love the lightsaber combat, the lightsaber action. So, there's not a big, you know, deep reason behind it. I just find it amazing and fantastic, and it's fun and exciting. And you've already talked about how it, you know, the Jedi see it as, you know, well, it is combat, yes. It's also an art form, and that's an art form I wish I could which I could use myself.
And I think, you know, the lightsaber action in the prequels are what made kids go outside and want to run around with a lightsaber. Even more so. I mean, everybody loved it in the OT too. And obviously it was very popular there. But I mean, at least for myself as a kid, I always, when I used to play Star Wars as a kid, I always pretended to have a blaster. So, you know, that was the most exciting element of Star Wars to me as a kid. I wanted to be like Han Solo. I wanted a blaster. But after watching episode one, I was like, I traded in my blaster for a lightsaber.
There you go.
And because it was just such a fun element to it and such an exciting way of using it. And I think, you know, I think the prequels specifically are the reason that a lot of fan-made movies were made with lightsabers. You know, it's because of the prequel lightsaber fights. It wasn't because of the OT specifically.
Right.
So, you know, they were so diligent with giving it a new flavor and giving it a very specific language that, you know, it just drew people in even more so.
Exactly. And it's amazing.
Yes. So. Yes.
All right. What's your number four?
Well, my number four is two words. Obi-Wan Kenobi.
There you go.
That's Obi-Wan's one word.
Obi-Wan, I think. It's a hyphenated. Yeah, it's hyphenated. Okay.
But Obi-Wan is just the consistently most awesome character in the prequels, and probably the most consistently well acted, except, you know, obviously I would put Ian McDiarmid right up there too as Palpatine. But and that's all thanks to Ewan McGregor. Ewan McGregor is a boss as Obi-Wan Kenobi. Yes. And he does. He pays such great homage to Sir Alec Guinness, but still making it his own character. Which it should be. It's a younger Obi-Wan. It's an Obi-Wan in his heyday before, you know, everything falls apart. And the Obi-Wan Kenobi that we meet in the prequels and that develops and grows through the prequels is really kind of the epitome of what a Jedi ought to be. I would say even more so than Yoda. Because, well, for starters, Obi-Wan literally is human. So he is more relatable than a little green guy. But also, you know, there is something more realistic about Obi-Wan. And, you know, obviously this was fleshed out a lot in the Clone Wars with his relationship with Sabine, you know, to learn that Obi-Wan himself even had a little thing with a, you know, with a romantic interest. You know, Obi-Wan is as real as it gets, yet still so disciplined as a Jedi. You know, he's just a one of a kind character in those stories. And we really do see him grow. You know, Qui-Gon was right. He does become a far wiser and great Jedi than he could ever be. You know, just watching that development is amazing. And I also think, you know, the prequel movies are essentially a tragedy of the fall of Anakin, but they're also a tragedy for Obi-Wan, if you think about it. And I was thinking about this the other night when I was watching Revenge of the Sith. You know, when they're after the duel's over and they're flying out of Mustafar and, you know, Ewan McGregor's doing his typical beard rub, his goatee rub. That look in his face though of just loss is incredible. And it really hit me of like, oh my gosh, this guy lost everything too. He loses his family, which are the Jedi. He loses his best friend and he loses the government he spent his whole life supporting and fighting for. He loses everything. And I think that really makes you, it really breaks your heart for him, but also makes him that much more of a hero because he doesn't just recede into the night, never to return. He recedes into the shadows for now until the time is right. And I think that's great. Even though he's lost everything, he's still going to devote himself to a future. And, you know, it's just, he's such a great character for these movies.
He is. He really is. Old Ben Kenobi was, you know, a revered character from the original trilogy. But you didn't know too much about him other than the fact that he was a Jedi and he knew Luke's father and he, you know, and his apprentice turned to the dark side and betrayed and murdered the Jedi. And this is the Obi-Wan we get in the prequels fleshes that out so much more. Excuse me. And then what we get with him in the prequels makes what Alec Guinness did in the original trilogy that much more impactful, that much more interesting. And one of the successes of the prequels is how it changes the way or enhances the way that we see the original trilogy. Mm-hmm. It gives more weight to the characters. And Obi-Wan is one of those characters that you love. He's a cool guy in the prequels. He really is. He's, you know, charming and funny at times, and he's good-natured most of the time, and when he's not being judgmental in The Phantom Menace. No, I'm kidding. but he goes through a journey where he has to take on the role of a mentor, and he's not sure he's up to the challenge, but he does it out of reverence and respect for his master, and gives it his best, and by the end of the day, he and Anakin are best friends, brothers, and then he loses it all. But through it all, he remains true to what a Jedi is and what he believes a Jedi should do. And that strength of character is rivaled only by Luke Skywalker's in the Star Wars saga at this point. Maybe Rey, but we've only got one movie with her so far.
Right. Well, I think Obi-Wan is, in a way, he's the character rock of the prequels. He's the one you can always rely on and count on. And and I think that's an extremely important part. And part of what makes Anakin's tragedy even more tragic is watching Obi-Wan's reaction to it.
Yeah.
Because we're forced to watch it through his eyes as well, which kind of stinks. Obi-Wan is by far one of the greatest parts. And as my friend Greg said, give us a Obi-Wan trilogy, please. Or at least a standalone movie with Ewan McGregor. Yes,
please. Please bring back Ewan.
I'd rather that than a Han Solo or a Boba Fett movie any day of the week. So,
hear, hear.
Yes. Anyway, Jason.
Yes.
What's your third one?
My number three, and this is going to be a little bit out of universe, but the music. The music of the prequels is one of the greatest things in the prequels. Everyone, you would be hard-pressed to find someone who wouldn't agree with that statement. The music of the prequels is fantastic. It builds off of what was developed for the original trilogy, takes it in a new direction, and adds so much to it. Of course, the addition of the chorus is something that John Williams really used big time to help tell the tragedy that the prequels would become. And there is so much great action music in this. There's so much great, just beautiful melodies. Obviously, Attack Across the Stars is one of the most beautiful pieces in all of the Star Wars soundtracks. It's gorgeous. And I'm not going to spend too much time talking about it because David Collins does so much better doing that on Star Wars Oxygen. You should go listen to that if you haven't already. I'm waiting for the next one to be released so I can listen to more great music and commentary about it. But I'm all the way caught up, by the way, finally on Star Wars Oxygen. So
nice.
But I love the music, and it was getting the Phantom Menace soundtrack for my birthday that really sent me into my love of classical music and film scores, which is my primary genre of music that I listen to now. So I have to mention it simply because of that. but also because it's outstanding. And John Williams was cheated because he didn't win the Oscar for any of those.
He did for the first one.
Oh, he did? Yes. For Phantom?
No,
he did. That's right. No, he
didn't. Oh, I'm sorry. For A New Hope. I'm sorry. I thought you meant like any of...
No, the prequels. Specifically the prequels. Yeah, he didn't win for any of the prequels.
No.
The Academy decided that George Lucas and Star Wars didn't need any awards. And while they were nominated, they snubbed him for most of it, except technical things.
Right.
Which is nice because they were pushing the technical envelope, but music definitely deserved it. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting because that's also my third.
Oh, wow.
I absolutely love the music of the prequels, which isn't hard to believe. It's Star Wars. It's John Williams. Right. And of course, we're going to love the darn music. And I'll echo a lot of what you said, but I think there is so many unique elements in the prequel trilogy. I mean, we get kind of fun and innocent styled music a lot in The Phantom Menace. And then, it leads up to like very kind of epic sounding tragic music for much of Revenge of the Sith.
Right.
You know, we get such a different, very varying degrees of music in the prequels. And it's perfect because, again, John Williams lets his music tell the story. You know, George Lucas always said, in a way, my movies are silent movies, and, to some degree, there's certain parts of Attack of the Clones I wish they were silent movies and John Williams could just be the language. But, but again, he does such a great job of really capturing the feel of these movies. And that's why, I'm so sad by the fact that he just keeps getting older. I mean, can't he go to Neverland for a few years and come back?
Can we just I think if anybody deserves to be cloned, it's John Williams.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Although we should be careful with that because we don't want to create a clone army of John Williams's.
It would be a musical assault.
It would be. And full of turtlenecks.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, baby. You just keep saying, hey, baby. Jason, baby. Carl, baby. I like the Wampusler, baby.
Yes.
This music is, for all sorts of reasons, incredible. We get first time ever Star Wars. Well, no, I was about to say it's the first time they ever got a music video, but I forgot about Lapti Nek for Return of the Jedi. Mm. We got a huge, response from not even Star Wars fans to Duel of the Fates music video. And then we got a great Attack of the Clones or Across the Stars music video. Did they do a music video for Battle of the Heroes? I don't remember.
I believe
one.
They did.
Okay.
I believe they did.
I wouldn't be surprised. But I remember with that soundtrack, they gave you that bonus disc with Ian McDiarmid talking about the music, which was really cool.
Yes. Yeah. And the video that was in there for Battle of the Heroes on that bonus disc is the Battle of the Heroes music video that they released, I believe.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't met with quite as much fanfare as Duel of the Fates or
Across the Stars.
Across the Stars. I think it was released kind of late in the game too.
Sure.
So,
well, I think for a lot of people were soured by episodes 1 and 2, so I don't think it had the same exposure to a degree. You can't say enough about any of John Williams' music, but I think especially in the prequels, it takes on a different, to me, it's a very different element too. It is. It's more, there is a more level of epicness to the music of the prequels than the OT. When I do listen to certain Star Wars music to ever get pumped up, 98% of the time is from the prequels. So
it's good pump up stuff.
It is. And like you mentioned, when that Phantom Menace soundtrack came out and spoiled the fate of Qui-Gon. But when that soundtrack came out, I'll never forget it. It had the fold out poster. Naboo was on the CD. It was just a picture of Naboo. And I loved it. I just remember listening to that soundtrack on repeat, and I would listen to it with my little CD Walkman out on the front yard, laying in a hammock, reading the Phantom Menace novel right after the movie came out, listening to that music. That soundtrack definitely overtook everything else I was listening to when it came out. And I think to this day, it is still my favorite standalone Star Wars soundtrack album. Even though Empire is my favorite music and like as a whole, if I'm ever going to just listen to a solitary Star Wars soundtrack album, it's always Phantom Menace. I love that music. And it does, obviously, it's a lot of those elements are reused in episodes 2 and 3 as well.
Right. Yeah. It is a phenomenal soundtrack.
Yes. And so. I am very excited to say that, cross my fingers, but I'm pretty sure I'm going to be seeing John Williams in concert in a week and a half at the Boston Pops conducting, and they're going to be playing Force Awakens music for the first time live. I can't wait. Yeah. There's a lady at the church I work at who works for the Boston Pops, and the tickets sold out like overnight, but she's using her powers to wiggle me and a friend in, and they're probably going to get like kind of the crappier seats, but I was like, I don't care where I'm sitting as long as I can hear.
There you go.
Because if I hear Ray's theme live, I'm going to cry. So I hope we get a prequel song in there too. I'm sure we'll get at least one.
I hope so.
Yes.
I hope so.
But anyway, I'm glad that we
play Anakin's theme and then Rey's theme.
I'm going to cry so hard.
Yeah. Okay.
It's just not going to, the tears won't stop. I'll be like, do you even have a ticket? And I'll be like, kind of. I lost it. It's wet with tears.
Use it as a tissue.
Yeah. But that's great. I'm glad we both shared that and it's high up there in our list. Because
Yeah,
it's awesome. Absolutely awesome.
It's fantastic. All right. I guess that gets us to number two.
I guess it does, Jason.
Well, my number two is Palpatine's manipulations. I'm a fan of Palpatine, which is funny because I'm the good guy. You know, I'm a total goody two-shoes. But Palpatine is fascinating to me. His story, the way that he's set himself up, and the way that he manipulates not only the Senate and the galaxy to put himself into power and to, you know, bring about the fall of the Republic and the rise of his empire and the rise of the Sith again and the fall of the Jedi, but the way he manipulates Anakin too and his fall. The way that Palpatine is this puppet master that orchestrates everything and he seems to know everything and is five steps ahead of everyone and has planned for every eventuality is remarkable and makes him my favorite villain in all of Star Wars. You know, Darth Vader is cool and all, but Palpatine's the one that got him there, you know? And so, and of course he's played by the wonderful Ian McDiarmid, who was fantastic and I thought should have gotten an Academy Award nomination at least for supporting actor with Revenge of the Sith. But he didn't. And he, like you said earlier, also one of the most consistently well-played characters throughout the entire saga, the entire prequels. And of course now saga, because he's in, you know, Empire in addition to what he did in Jedi. But I love Palpatine. I can't like put an exact finger on it, but he fascinates me. And he's not overly imposing, but he somehow holds all the power and makes everyone love him anyways. You know, especially in the prequels, right before the fall of the Republic. Everyone loves him. He's super popular in the Senate.
Yeah.
And they just keep giving him more and more and more power. And he stayed in office longer than he should have. You know, his terms were up by the time we got to Attack of the Clones.
Yeah.
But he was still in power. And then he was granted the emergency powers, which kept him in power even longer for another 3 years. And everyone wanted him to stay in the Senate for continuity during the war or something. Anakin mentioned something like that, you know, that they asked him to stay on. You know, I believe he says that in Revenge of the Sith. And I don't know. I just love him. And he's fascinating to me. And the fact that he orchestrates all the tragedy that happens in the prequel trilogy is the result of one man's plan. And it's just devious. And is fascinating. And when you get a villain like that who can orchestrate everything around his will and his plan to get that tragedy is remarkable. And the way that they pulled that off with the prequels, I love it.
Yeah. He's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much more to say. You kind of nailed it all. He's not one of my favorite elements. He'd definitely be on a list if this list was a little bigger. Mm-hmm. Kind of in a way, like, you know, you said, in a similar way to Obi-Wan, he is just a consistently great character, but he's a consistently great villain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of my biggest critiques still of the prequels is just that, we kind of have the villain of the day in each movie, you know, Darth Maul, then Count Dooku, then General Grievous. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I guess it's true, though. The true villain of the entire prequels, though, is Palpatine. It's Sidious. You know, so that's an incredible part that he plays, because he is the perfect villain, because he's never out there in the front. And the only time when he is exposed and he's at the front, things have already started to happen. He plays everything just perfectly. You know, I mean, we did an episode a long time ago that, you know, we called it like the puppet master or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we talked for like 3 hours.
with Lord Bruticus.
Yeah. We've talked about this, but I mean, you're absolutely right. He is just such a great character for these movies. And he's the reason that the government falls apart, that Anakin falls, and that the Jedi are eradicated. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of these horrible things come out of one person's will. And that's the thing too that makes Palpatine, you know, a very unique villain is that he is your black and white villain. He's what we thought Vader was. He's even what we thought maybe Maul or Count Dooku was. But we get enough of backstory of them through, you know, other things that we know that in some way that even they were corrupted. Palpatine seems like, just at least what we get in the films, he's just pure evil. His will is power for the sake of power. And that's the scariest type of person to ever have power.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I would almost equate him to Hitler, because, you know, Hitler just liked power for power's sake. But he's different than Hitler, because Hitler was a lot more charismatic, I think, than Palpatine is. Palpatine's more sly. Something I like about Palpatine, though, too, that we get in the Clone Wars series is we do see that, you know, in certain episodes, how popular he also is with the public. You know, the commoner likes Palpatine. The common folk on Coruscant love Palpatine. He's got posters and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
He's well-liked by everybody. He plays that gentle grandfather figure very well.
Yes.
And gets everybody's attention. But underneath all of that is Darth Sidious.
Right.
His true identity.
Exactly. Palpatine is a well-crafted mask that he wears. And he knows the perfect time to take it off. And uses that to great effect in Revenge of the Sith. So.
Indeed.
So what's your number two?
Well, my number two is simply Coruscant. I love Coruscant. You know, I mean, it was... And what I love about it, too, is it never was called Coruscant until the EU. That's actually... Well, Legends. But Legends is actually what gave it its name. The capital planet in George Lucas's original screenplay was not Coruscant. I can't remember what it was called exactly, but it's not Coruscant.
I don't recall either.
But he changes the name. And, you know, we get our first glimpse of it in the Return of the Jedi Special Edition. But Coruscant just looks so cool to me. And it's funny because, like, I grew up in a small town. Woods were all around me. It's all old farm country. So when I first moved to Boston, I was just like, oh, I hate this. It's concrete jungle, you know? But what's so funny is I've been here for a number of years now, and I love it, and I love cities. And whenever I'm in the country now, after like an afternoon in the country, I'm like, ah, God, get me back to the city. It's so funny how I've changed. So, and I think, you know, even that personal preference informs how I look at Coruscant. I didn't care as much about Coruscant 10 years ago, but now whenever I watch the prequels, it's my favorite thing to look at. I think it looks great from space. Like, it's just such a cool visual of, you know, like, you see all these rings of lights, you know. It looks so cool. It's the one place I'd love to visit in the Star Wars galaxy, and we get it in the prequels. And it's also, it's the main setting of the prequels. You know, it's kind of the rock, if you will. It's the foundation. It's the home space of the prequels, which I would almost argue the Millennium Falcon acts as that in the original trilogy. It's one of the most common settings that we find our characters. Coruscant is the common setting we find our characters throughout the prequel trilogy. And I think that that's really important, because if, in a sense, it acts as the home for the prequel movies. And we watch the home fall apart. And when home falls apart, things fall apart.
right.
You know, and I think that's a really important element of the Coruscant story. And it does. It all comes down to like my favorite visual scene in all of Star Wars, not just the prequels, in all of Star Wars, is that scene right after Grievous talks to Sidious, you know, about, you know, how he'll soon have a new apprentice, far younger and more powerful. And you get that beautiful shot of the city. And again, when you get to Revenge of the Sith, the CGI to me is just, it's pitch perfect, especially at night. It looks like a real city. And it looks like a Star Wars city. And then you get the great scene of, you know, Padme and Anakin on the balcony. And, you know, not the best dialogue ever, but I don't care. I'm so busy looking at the beautiful cityscape and I'm lost. I don't care. I'm in love too. Love has blinded me to the bad dialogue.
So, especially with that lone violin playing there.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. And it is. It is our home. You know, the Jedi Temple's there. The Senate's there. Palpatine's apartment's there. Padme's apartment is there. And that's where we spend a lot of our time in specifically episodes 2 and 3.
Right. Now, it is a very interesting place. I am not a city person. I prefer the suburbs or the countryside. I don't have the fondness for Coruscant as you do, but I do like the fact that we get to see so much of it. It is definitely the most explored location in the prequels. We have the Senate, like you said, the Senate, the Jedi Temple, the offices and the apartments of some of our characters. We also get to see the Undercity in Attack of the Clones, and we get this other side to Coruscant. You know, on the surface it's glamorous and glitzy and, you know, sleek and fast, but you get down, you know, to where the sun doesn't shine because it's so, you know, the buildings are so tall. It's dark and it's grungy, and the riffraff are all out, you know, that sort of thing. And it's almost a whole separate world. And so it is the most fleshed out location in the prequels. And, you know, I like that about it. Not my favorite location. I'm much more of a fan of Naboo than Coruscant. But Coruscant is actually going to relate to my number one, which is the Jedi Order, because that's where the Jedi are headquartered. My favorite thing about the prequels is learning about the Jedi Order, seeing all the members of the Jedi Order, learning who they are, you know, digging into all these different characters on the Jedi Council, that sort of thing. But really finding out what the Jedi Order was during the twilight years of the Republic. We get sort of hints and ideas from the original trilogy about what the Jedi Order was and, you know, how they operated. But this is really, we get to see it. We get to experience it. We, you know, in The Phantom Menace, we get to see, you know, early on with Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon, how Jedi operate. And then we get to see where they're headquartered with the Jedi Temple. And the Jedi Temple is probably my favorite location on Coruscant. It's this simple yet elegant place. And there's, you know, a lot of areas there for contemplation, I'm sure. But it's not overly cluttered with, you know, trinkets, obviously, because Jedi, you know, don't have possessions. But it's this grand, large, simple, elegant structure. And I like that. And just who the Jedi are, how they operate, the way they look, that sort of thing is by far probably my favorite element of the prequels. You know, everyone knows I'm a fan of the Jedi, so this should come as no surprise. That's my number one element of the prequels. But learning who they are and learning that by the time we get to the prequels, they have sort of stagnated. They're not who they should be as an order.
The Jedi are not what they once was.
Yes. Exactly. Much like the Senate, they're full of greedy, squabbling delegates. but they are. They've become a bureaucracy, and they are almost, at this point, a police force controlled by the Senate rather than an autonomous entity, which I feel like if Luke would have had his way, would have been how it would have been with his new Jedi Order during the sequel trilogy. But that's neither here nor there because they're gone at this point.
Thanks, Kylo.
Right. So, but yeah, Jedi Order. Love it. Number one.
I'm not surprised, Jason.
I would have been shocked if you had been surprised.
The only reason the Jedi actually aren't on my list is because everything I love about Jedi, we don't really get in the prequels for the reasons you're saying. I'm not slamming it. It's the reason the Jedi kind of are able to fall apart is because they've become so bureaucratic. They've become so obsessed with the dogmas and the doctrines that they forget the heart of what it means to be a Jedi, which is simply, as Yoda says in the Clone Wars, to make the Force known. You know, so they're failing in that. So, you know, if we had gotten a little bit more of that element in the prequels, the Jedi probably would have been right at the top of my list as well, because that's what I love about Star Wars. I love the you know, mystical element, the spiritual element of Star Wars, which is encapsulated by the Force and then the Jedi who use the Force. But unfortunately, all we see the Jedi really being in the prequels is a police force, a bureaucracy, a leadership conference, you know.
Yeah.
They're not who they're supposed to be. And that's why they're not on my list. I still like them visually. I like that we see them. I like that they're such a big part of the government. And but I think even that in and of itself is part of the reason they fall as well. The Jedi are way too involved in political affairs.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a huge fan of separation of church and state. You know, that's what I love about America. The Jedi don't seem to understand that. so, you know, you can become corrupted when you're part of a corrupt system. And I think that's the thing. The Jedi have been involved for far too long with a system that's become increasingly corrupt, and that corruption bleeds into their own order. I don't think that they're like inherently evil people or selfish people the way that the squabbling delegates of the Senate are.
Right.
But, you know, their attention is constantly being drawn away from where it should be, which is always on what's the Force? What is the Force telling us? What's the will of the Force? You know, when we get a lot of that in Attack of the Clones with Mace Windu, who I hate, Mace Windu is constantly bringing to light the fact that, you know, our ability to use the Force is diminished. You know, it's because you're not really using it, you know, when you are using it, they use it in combat a lot, but that's all they're really using it for.
Yeah.
I think we do get a lot of great stuff of the Jedi in the Clone Wars series, but the films themselves, again, it's very absent. And I think, and again, it's on purpose. It's not right. It's not like George Lucas screwed that up. He did it so awesomely. But the only reason it's not on my list is because I don't like who they've become.
Right. I can understand that. Yeah. So, but what's your number one?
Are you ready for it?
I have a sneaking suspicion I might know what it might entail, but go ahead.
It's not J.J. Abrams.
No.
It's Jar Jar Binks. No, I'm kidding. No, for me, my favorite thing about the prequels is the sense of innocence.
Mm-hmm. Comes from Phantom Menace.
Exactly, which to me, I still can't decide whether I like Phantom Menace more than Revenge of the Sith, but I think Phantom Menace is the best film in the prequel trilogy. And I know a lot of people would disagree with me. A lot of people don't like it. But the reason I love it so much is because what it does for the overall overarching story of Star Wars. It's our Eden. It's the story of how the good things became bad. You know, right. The music specifically of The Phantom Menace, it does have that kind of light, beautiful, innocent feel that, you know, Anakin's theme is the perfect example of it, that encapsulates where the prequels start, that everything was good and everything was beautiful, but it all fell apart. Mm-hmm. And there's something, you know, when Phantom Menace came out, I was, because that came out in 99, so I was 13 when it came out. I wasn't quite 14 yet. So I was still at that age where I played with the action figures. I was running around outside. You know, I've told the story a number of times about pretending to do the Duel of Fates on our covered bridge. You know, there was such an element that seized my imagination again. And I think that the Phantom Menace had the freedom to do that in the way that 2 and 3 couldn't. 2 and 3 had to start becoming darker stories about how things fell apart.
Right.
So that kind of that beauty and innocent imagination element was kind of absent from the other two, understandably. But
right.
Phantom Menace really grabs hold of it, and we're clinging to it in episode 2. In episode 3, we lose it.
Yeah.
And it's sad. It is a tragedy, but I love that it's there. I love that sense of hope that exists kind of early on in the prequels. And, you know, I don't know if you ever... Did you ever play the Phantom Menace video game? It was like the story video game. It came out for the computer and PS1, I think. I think it was for PlayStation 1.
I think I played it like once or twice at a friend's house, but I never had it.
Okay. Well, I played that game. I had it for the PlayStation 1, and I loved that game. And there's a lot of great parts, levels on Naboo specifically. And it's really cool. Sometimes when you play in a video game and you really get to like explore a location in a video game, you almost get like an intimate knowledge of it. I used to just have so much fun playing Phantom Menace. Phantom Menace came out in the spring, like all Star Wars movies, but I just remember being able to run around outside, and there was, you know, the summer was coming. So when you're a kid, like that gets you excited.
Right.
So I have, you know, and I think this is a thing that is really unfair of a lot of Star Wars fans that they do to people who love the prequels. For a lot of people, the prequels informed their childhood in the same way that the OT informed others. So you grew up with those elements, and
oh, yeah,
they helped form you. And Phantom Menace really did that for me when I was a younger kid, even more so than the OT, I guess, because it was new. It was something like specifically coming out at that time. So that sense of innocence is so wonderful that we get from the prequels. And I think it is trying to tell us specifically in Phantom Menace that everything is inherently good, but it can become corrupted. That's the impression I get. So it really is kind of that Garden of Eden experience. And yeah, I'm mostly looking at Phantom Menace here. And I said this to Jason before we started recording, but after watching Phantom Menace the last couple times, I actually got to say, I like Jar Jar Binks. And I never thought I would say that. Jason, it took 180 episodes.
There we are. I have accomplished my mission. I can quit podcasting. No, I'm kidding. Yeah,
this is the last episode of The Wampa's Lair. but you know, I would never say Jar Jar is one of my favorite characters, definitely not, but I enjoyed his character for what George Lucas was trying to do. He's making a light, fun character for kids, and I laughed a couple times. I will always love, "Hello, boyos."
Hello, boyos.
And then at the end when the generator, the command ship has been destroyed, look, and Jar Jar pushes it over and says,
"They are broken."
I love it. Like, it's cheesy, but it's funny. Like, it's cute. And I enjoy that element of the prequels, and that the prequels can give us that. So that to me is my favorite part of the Star Wars prequels.
There you go. I love it. I love the fact that that made your list. And I know we've talked about the innocence of the Phantom Menace on and off for, you know, probably the last year now, maybe since we did our commentary, maybe.
Right.
But, and I like what you said, how Phantom Menace sort of gives us this Garden of Eden experience. You know, the innocence is there. It shows us the innocence. We live in that innocence. And then Attack of the Clones, we're trying to hold on to that with, and particularly with the romance between Anakin and Padme. You know, that's the most innocent part of Attack of the Clones. Story-wise, of course, you know, got all this the storm clouds are gathering in the galaxy as the Clone Wars is getting ready to begin. And then by the time we get to Revenge of the Sith, it's all lost because everything falls apart, including the romance, the love story between Anakin and Padme. It's ripped apart, and it's, you know, obviously ends very horribly. But I love the fact that is taking a hold of you so much that's your number one. That's awesome to me. I love that. And the prequels are my Star Wars. Yes, I watched the special editions of the original trilogy before I saw the prequels, but I was 10. I was turning 10 when Phantom Menace came out, 13 when Attack of the Clones hit, and 16, excuse me, when Revenge of the Sith.
Excuse me.
Revenge of the Sith happened. And each of those movies hit me at the perfect time. You know, I grew up with them. Mm-hmm. Because those movies do grow up.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't think the OT needed to. But you get, you know, the very innocent Phantom Menace. Attack of the Clones is full of angst and uncertainty with, you know, it's going through puberty. And then you get, you know... then you just get the tragedy, obviously, the culmination with Revenge of the Sith. And those movies do grow up, and it hit, and I hit all the right ages for me with that. And so that is why I'm such a fan of the prequels, and why when people really give them a chance and look at them objectively and not through the lens of, well, they're not like the original trilogy, that makes me happy. You know, if it's still not your favorite, fine. I can live with that. But if you give it the chance that I think it deserves, that's all I can ask. So.
Right. You know, because how old were you again when the Phantom Menace came out?
I was turning 10. Because these movies all come out
right around your birthday.
Right about my birthday.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, and they're a few months before mine. But yeah, so I mean, I'm jealous because, like, I wish I was just a few years younger. Like, if I got to see Phantom Menace when I was 9 or 10, and then, you know, 12, 13 for the next one, it would have been the perfect progression, you know. And I get why kids who were in that age bracket, or even younger, or maybe, you know, right around my age, that's why you did. You loved those movies and the story that they told. And I think you're absolutely right. It's unfair to look at them and hold them up to the OT because they're not the same story. They're not meant to be. You know, and I was just thinking this too. Obviously, I didn't put this on my list, which, again, he would have been at some point. But Qui-Gon Jinn, to me, is obviously one of the best parts of the prequels, but he's really only in Phantom Menace. And I think that's interesting, just kind of going back to, you know, what we were talking about a little bit earlier about the Jedi. Qui-Gon is the only person who is like a spiritual mentor in the whole movie. You get a tiny bit from Yoda in Attack of the Clones and a tiny bit in Revenge of the Sith, but it's just all that non-attachment talk. Qui-Gon's the only one who's giving us like really new ways of looking at the Force, but then he dies. And notice that element is then gone. Qui-Gon is kind of the last hope of the Jedi to recapture who they were. He's not allowed on the council because he's almost like indicting them for what they've become. You know, not verbally or aggressively, but Qui-Gon is kind of an indictment of what the Jedi aren't doing. You know, be mindful of the living Force, young council.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And I do love that, because then at the end of Revenge of the Sith, he becomes Yoda's master. Like, how awesome is that?
It's great. It's great.
Anywho.
All right.
Jason, can I go through my ranking of the Star Wars films in light of all my prequel love?
Sure.
It's not that much different, but okay. No surprise, Empire is my favorite.
Oh, darn.
Followed by Return of the Jedi.
Okay.
Followed by The Force Awakens.
Okay.
Followed very, 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 very closely by Revenge of the Sith. Followed extremely even closer by Phantom Menace. And then A New Hope and Attack of the Clones. And there I know all of our older fans right now want to shoot me or lightsaber me through the heart. Like Kylo Ren, you know what I'm saying, because A New Hope is so low. But I'm sorry, this is not one of my favorite Star Wars movies. And I think I have way more fun watching Phantom Menace than I've ever had watching A New Hope. So, and that's all that matters. It's about how they make you feel.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
I smell a 1-star review on the iTunes store. When you like Phantom Menace more than A New Hope, you're doing it wrong.
Well, but I've been doing it wrong for a long time.
No, anyway. Oh,
all right. Well, this has been fun. I've enjoyed this episode.
Me too.
Yes.
I'm going to go watch the prequels again. No, I'm kidding. Or am I?
But you came up with a great matchup for us at the end of this episode. So why don't you go ahead and introduce that?
All right. Well, I thought it'd be fun to do a team matchup again, but all prequel based. So we have a master apprentice lightsaber duel between. So here's our, we have our episode one matchup of Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon, a master and apprentice, versus the episode two master apprentice, Obi-Wan and Anakin. So yes, I realize Obi-Wan's on the list twice. He can't fight himself literally. I realize. But we're looking at Qui-Gon as the master, Obi-Wan as the apprentice, versus Obi-Wan the master and Anakin the apprentice from Attack of the Clones. So Phantom Menace, master apprentice versus Attack of the Clones, master apprentice. Who takes the cake?
Yes.
Or should I say the moof milk?
The blue milk.
Yes.
The Jawa juice.
Yeah.
You can want a cup of Jawa juice?
Yes, sure. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Awesome. Well, I'm curious to see what everyone says about that matchup. I'm curious to see what I say about that matchup. I still haven't decided. But, wow. We've talked about a lot of things. And Carl, if people want to weigh in on our matchup or weigh in on anything we may have discussed here, where can they do that?
Well, they can head on over to our Coruscant base, because it's the prequels, on Facebook, facebook.com/WampusLairPodcast. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/WampusLair, or shoot us an email at WampusLairPodcast@gmail.com.
All right, anything else before we wrap this up?
Just ready to party with those little people on Naboo.
There you go. All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of the Wampus Lair Podcast. This has been episode number 180, Top 5 Prequel Elements. For Carl, I'm Jason, and we will see you next time here in the Wampus Lair.